Welcome to the Sutliffian Report, the place where the news is never hidden and the truth always wins. Today we have Len Getz, a retired CPA for the IRS and the Philadelphia associate with the Counter-Islamist Group, a project of the Middle East Forum. That's an interview that should cause many to think about what ethics exist in those who review charities. But this is a Christian news show, and we always start with a passage from the Bible. Today, we're reading Joshua 9, 1 to 14. And it came to pass when all the kings, which were on this side of the Jordan, the hills, and in the valleys, and all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite, and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard thereof, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, they did work wily and went and made as if they had been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles and old rent and round and bound up and old shoes and clotted upon their feet and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provisions was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal and said unto him and to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. Now therefore make a league with us, make a pact with us. And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, peradventure you dwell among us. How shall we make a league with you? How shall we make a pact? And they said unto Joshua, we are your servants. And Joshua said unto them, who are you, and from where do you come? And they said unto him, from a very far country, your servants are come because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard the fame of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtra. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, take victuals with you for the journey, and go and meet unto them, we are your servants. Therefore now make a pact with us. This is our bread we took for our provisions out of our houses on the day we came forth to go unto you. But now, behold, it is dry and it is moldy. And these bottles of wine which we filled were new, and behold, they're rent. And these our garments and our shoes became old by reason of the very long journey. And the men took of the victuals and asked not counsel of God. One of the dumbest things we do is trust in our own wisdom. Even when we have a buzzer going off in our head screaming something's not right, we sometimes make a choice that is not only wrong, but so bad its consequences are lasting. Why do we do these things when we have a God who listens to our prayers? Why do we trust in our own understanding? We should know better. The Word of God says it's not in man to direct his own steps. That comes from Jeremiah 10:23. When you do your daily devotions, you notice that your life is better for it. But even when we do this and pray, we still make bad choices that our brains scream afterwards, you should have known better. How many of those bad choices were made without even seeking God's counsel for an answer? I know for myself that answer is a resounding 100%. This is one mistake it's hard to break away from. We want to trust in our own knowledge and judgment, our own selfishness and our independence, sounding like the toddler saying, I can do it, with a sour face, and the parent knowing they cannot still says no. How many times does it take to call upon God for an answer? This is the insanity in our selfishness in not asking God. Dear Lord Jesus, help us, Lord, to put aside our own selfishness and seek you first before that of our own understanding. Lord God, we know that it is not you that we do not trust. Lord, you give us many reasons to trust you. Lord, make me a better prayer warrior. Mold me into a person who desires to seek you out more each day. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, this week I interviewed Len Getz, as I said, a retired CPA for the IRS and the Philadelphia associate with the Counter-Islamist Group, a project of the Middle East Forum, to learn more about his article in American Thinker on the lax ethics of the Charity Review Council. This interview has action points for you patriots who are listening. If you're interested in taking part in getting active on the issue, please contact me and I'll share with you an action plan. Without further ado, here is that interview. Today I have with me Len Getz. Len is a former CPA for the IRS and is the Philadelphia associate with the Counter-Islamist Grid, a project of the Middle East Forum. Welcome to Sutlifian Report, Len. Your article on American Thinker, Charities Review Council Stumbles Regarding CARE, should be catching the eye of every philanthropist in the United States. Let's start with the basics. Who are the Charities Review Council?
Well, it's always good to be on your show, Paul. Really appreciate being here and reaching out to all your listeners. It's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here. And thank you very much for inviting me. So the article, as you mentioned, was published in the American Thinker and explains that the Charity Reviews Council, it's a nationwide organization that strives to match donors with nonprofit organizations that they deem meets its so-called accountability standards. It's been around since 1946, and it claims that it works to strengthen nonprofits' internal policies and accountability, and prides itself that every precious dollar goes to strong, ethical, and trustworthy nonprofits. They claim to educate the nonprofits about transparency, and how transparency is a crucial aspect of meeting its rigorous, so-called rigorous accountability standards. And they say that its strategic priorities include culturally responsible giving and being a model for integrity. So that's what they say they're about.
Wow.
Yeah.
I find it shocking that a Charities Review Council who makes recommendations to philanthropists, these are the people that have the extra cash to give away, on where they're advising them on where the money should go, they don't really do any background work from what I just read in your article. This is amazing. You talk about an executive director of Charities Review Council, Chris Kuich, right? Is that how you say it?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Not having access to or information on the foundation of the Council on American Islamic Relations, aka CARE, or if you work in national security area or you have any wisdom in that area, they know them as Hamas in America. it just kind of blows my mind that they don't know. Yeah. But could you please tell us what happened this past November?
So they certainly have access to the information. They had just as much access as you or I. All you have to do is check into it, look them up. But it's very clear that they didn't even bother doing so, or they don't care. My guess is they didn't bother doing so. I noticed on the CARE Philadelphia website, there was an emblem that says, our organization meets the accountability standards of the Charities Review Council. And I didn't know anything about the Charities Review Council. So I went into their website and I saw indeed, who they were, what they're all about. And indeed they list CARE Pennsylvania and CARE California as meeting their criteria. So I contacted Chris Kuich, she's the executive director, and I asked her if she knows anything about, how the Council of American Islamic Relations began, and she had no idea. She had no idea who they were, how they were formed, and she seemed to welcome information about them. So I sent her information. I also explained to her that it began with the FBI actually wiretaped a meeting of Hamas leaders in a Philadelphia hotel in 1993, where these people were talking about, Hamas people were talking about establishing, forming CARE. I sent her information about how they were identified as a co-conspirator in the federal case against the Holy Land Foundation that raised money for Hamas in the United States. I showed her that the United Arab Emirates country, it's a Muslim country, but they designate CARE as a terrorist organization. I presented her with information about the state of Arkansas and that they passed a House resolution suspending outreach to CARE because their officials have been imprisoned on terrorist charges. I told her about the Commerce Department's Census Bureau that severed its partnership with CARE because of its ties to terrorism. I told her that at some point CARE lost its tax-exempt status because it failed to meet the standards of a tax-exempt organization. We failed to file its reports. You know, its form. You know, its 990s. And they were, and during this time, they actually were receiving money from foreign organizations. So they specifically, as I mentioned, Charity Review Council, they specifically mention CARE California and CARE Philadelphia. So I sent her information about how the Anti-Defamation League had exposed the executive director of Los Angeles CARE about his history of anti-Semitism, calling Israel a cancerous tumor, implying that the Holocaust is morally equivalent to supporting Zionism as ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, which is an absurd notion. The fact of the matter is the population of Palestinian Arabs have increased since Israel was established.
And this would make them a racist organization.
Well, I'll actually get into more racism in a minute. I also tell them about Jacob Bender. Jacob Bender is the executive director of Philadelphia CARE. And I sent her an article where he says, and I don't know where he comes up with these ideas. Maybe he goes to bed at night and thinks about ways how he can be more anti-Semitic than the day before. He writes an article where he says, Jewish Americans will argue that slavery is dwarfed by the Holocaust. And he accused Jews of counting the corpses competition. I don't know where he comes up with these ideas. It's absurd. But you know, they're actually in line with CARE's anti-Semitism in general. I told Chris that they lobbied against the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act of 2019, something that was adopted by the U.S. Department of Education. They also opposed the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, something that's been adapted by the U.S. State Department, and also, by the way, has recently been embraced by the Biden administration. I also told her about the instance, and if you remember this, Paul, a couple of years ago, there's a mosque in Philadelphia, the Muslim American Society Mosque, that uploaded a video of children singing about chopping off the heads of Jews, and we will liberate the Alaska Mosque. And Jacob Bender had commented about this. He said, this is not so bad. This is not radicalism. And then there's another mosque in Philadelphia called the Alaska Islamic Society. They had an imam there who delivered three anti-Semitic speeches at that mosque. And what does Jacob Bender do? He rewards the leadership by inviting them to their upcoming banquet. So Chris Kiewicz, she seemed grateful for all the information that I gave her. It's a lot of information. She said, you can give me more information. That would help me, to help the board form a decision about what to do. She said, give me a couple of months and I'll present all this information to the board in January so they can make their decision. But as I mentioned, I never heard back from them. And despite my efforts to contact them, we have several messages on her voicemail and sent her more emails. She never contacted me. And CARE Philadelphia, CARE Pennsylvania, and CARE California is still on their website as a recommended charitable organizations that donors should donate to.
It's shocking, no matter how it's said. I mean, this is not something we should I guess my biggest problem is the word ethics with the organization. If a charitable reviews council doesn't have ethics, how are they doing their reviews?
It's ethics, it's integrity. And I don't know, and now that this is out in the open, you wonder why donors should trust, you know, the charitable review council. You know, it's one thing for them to say, gee, you know, I was never informed about this. Thank you very much for letting us know. It's quite another thing that after they are informed about it, they do nothing and continue to recommend them. You know, it's really beyond belief. And I don't get it, you know. If you ask me, why do they continue to do that? Why do they continue to recommend them? Why are they ignoring everything I say? You know, I'd only be surmising.
And, so what do you recommend that the listeners and viewers do? Because there's got to be some way that we can help.
Right. So there is. The more the Charity Review Council hears from people, from organizations, that they read the article or that they heard about this and they want to do something about it, the more they hear from them, the more they hear from us, the more pressure they'll have, you know, that comes to bear, and you know, so they may do something about it. And if you go, I can tell you there's a her email is chris@smartgivers.org. chris@smartgivers.org. And then there's also a board member that you may want to contact. Her name is Megan Ginst-Tarno. And she can be contacted at Megan, M-E-G-A-N, at Mobius Group M-N. I'll spell that off for you. So it's M-E-G-A-N at MobiusGroupMN. .com. So if you would, if everybody would just, you know, email them, tell them that you agree that care should be taken off, and it really is a disgrace that they're still recommending an organization that's anti-Semitic and with ties to terrorism as an organization that donors should donate to.
And not to mention that they don't consistently report unless they get punished. This is crazy.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. You know, it's just mind-boggling how they're, I don't know. Like, you know what, by the way, I wanted to mention something else, which is really, it just shows you how they don't do their basic due diligence. Are you familiar with GuideStar?
Yes.
So GuideStar is it's a website, and you can get a lot of information about every organization, every tax exempt organization. It gives you a lot of information about them, where they are, what they do, their, you know, the tax exempt number.
I actually use them. So yes.
So if you go to the GuideStar link to CARE Pennsylvania, you'll be amazed at what you'll find. You go to that link and then you scroll down a little bit and you come to another link. And that link is actually links you to Stephen Emerson's investigative project organization. You click on that and you actually see all the things about that Stephen Emerson discovered, well, mostly people, you know, people like you and I know about CARE. It tells about how they're involved with how the FBI cut their relations with them. It talks about how they were co-conspirators in the Holy Land Foundation federal case. But this is actually on the GuideStar website. And you would think that an organization like Charities Review Council would do the basic, you know, the basic research. Just go
that, that's because they're not even looking at.
There.
You can't even be. There's no research being done. Holy cow. Wow.
It's right there. It's right in front. Now, did they look at that and say, yeah, we don't care. We're gonna recommend them anyway, or they just didn't do it? I think they just didn't do it.
I think it sounds to me like they either get paid to not do it or they just are too lazy to do any work.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty bad.
Well, even if they were, you know, and that's bad in itself. But once they're informed about it, you know, there's no excuse. There's absolutely no excuse.
Yes. Well, thank you, Len, for joining me. I think you've exposed the name is almost an oxymoron. Charities review.
What do they review?
They don't review.
They don't review anything. What do they review?
Oh, boy. I hope the people out there listening can think about what a joke of a name an organization is when you don't do what you claim in your name.
What are they reviewing? Duffy, what are they reviewing? They're just allowing the organization to tell them all about themselves, and they accept it at face value.
Well, while I have you here, I do want to remind people that Len is one of those people who really does go out and do the work. Len and I worked together on a project 2 years ago now.
Yet.
I can't believe this is 2 years old. Or a year and a half old at the very least. I just went back and looked at the article you wrote on colleges and how we used to go, how we should be reporting colleges for promoting propaganda.
Right.
And you and I worked on a project on the Georgetown University.
Right.
And still, they haven't had their nonprofit status revoked.
No, it was you and I worked, you and I and other people also worked long and hard.
Yeah.
About putting together that referral to the IRS, explaining to them how they are failing their tax exempt status with regard to as being an educational facility. We explained to them how they failed it and where they violated it, and we gave them specific criteria, specific evidence, and how they're failing it, and it was 80 pages.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It was just about exactly 80 pages, and it was very, very specific stuff, and there were footnotes and citations and everything,
Very well.
I know they don't have to respond to us, and I think maybe that is one of the things that maybe needs to change.
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, IRS can disclose their decisions, and they can't disclose information about other taxpayers, which is understandable. You wouldn't want them to disclose your record or my tax records. But the thing about the Georgetown is that we were after the there was a website that we were specifically going after. You know, the name actually is
Dave Bridges.
Bridges, that's right. That's right, Bridges. Right. So they're on the website is out there. So it's very clear. You can just go on there, and if they still exist, you know the IRS has done nothing about it.
Yes.
Nothing. You don't have to ask them. They know they've done nothing.
I think that's the shock for me. That having been an educator, retired from teaching. I mean, again, we're talking about organizations. This is the interesting thing for both of them to go together, because we're talking about unethical organizations that claim to be ethical in how it teaches, but yet it's using propaganda and misinformation to teach students.
And unfortunately, the students just don't know that they're being given a fistful of lies.
Yeah,
aware if they don't have the education, the background, they just accept it, and that's tragic. It doesn't bode well for our future.
That is incredibly true. Len, I want to say thank you for joining us, and we'll definitely have to have you back in the near future. God bless.
Always a pleasure to be here, Paul. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a joy to have someone like Len Getz join you, especially. A joy to have a chance to work with him on a project. I do want to encourage those who are listening to give me a call if you want to take part in this next project where we're, you know, it's time to start calling the donors to Charity Review Council and say, why are you accepting this lax of ethics in the Charity Review Council. If you're accepting a lax, I mean, that it's okay to be, you know, to give money to a group that has ties to terrorism. It's okay to give money to a group that is considered a terrorist entity by an ally of the United States government. If you're okay with that, how is that a, again, we need to call the donors. That's what it comes down to. You need to call the donors. You need to call as many people as you can that are related to the Charity Review Council. I submit that anybody who gets a review by the Charity Review Council, if they are saying pleasant things or bad things, how can you trust them if they can't review, they can't look and see what's out there? What kind of review are they actually doing? That's where I get concerned. Since you have to pay to get this review, does it sound like they pay more for, I mean, there's a lot of questions here, a lot of ethical questions that make you wonder what kind of review is actually done. Is this just a rubber stamp or is it something else? That's a really scary thing. Another issue out, ethical issue out there this week was caught by the Zakor Legal Institute. It's a think tank that combats anti-Semitism. Adam Credo of the Washington Free Beacon has the story. Now, this comes out, again, the Washington Free Beacon. The headline was Lawmaker Demands Investigation into Act Blue. This came out March 11th. Representative Tim Burchett out of Tennessee is demanding the Justice and Treasury Departments launch an investigation into the Act Blue charity platform following a Washington Free Beacon report exposing the organization's work with an anti-Israel group allegedly tied to multiple terror organizations. Burchett, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, says that Act Blue, an online donation portal that primarily serves liberal and Democrat-aligned organizations, could be violating U.S. anti-terrorism laws by facilitating donations to the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACBI, an anti-Israel organization that plays a central role in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. PACBI continues to be listed as a partner organization on Act Blue's website, despite being alerted earlier this month on PACBI's ties to foreign terrorist organizations. There's a core legal institute, a think tank that combats anti-Semitism, informed Act Blue's leadership that PACBI is a hate group that is controlled by a coalition of organizations that the United States and other countries have designated as foreign terror organizations. Burchett, in a Thursday letter addressed to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Attorney General Merrick Garland, said the Biden administration must uphold its repeated pledge to fight the BDS movement. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Wednesday that the administration opposes the BDS movement and will not shift its stance on combating efforts to boycott the Jewish state. Blinken is just the latest senior Biden administration official, including President Joe Biden himself, to come out and publicly against the BDS movement. Act Blue's ongoing partnership with PACBI is a flagrant violation of Act Blue's terms of service. But I am more troubled, again, this is Adam Credo saying this, by the fact, oops, I'm sorry, that's not, it's Birch. This would be, wow. Yeah. Let me just keep going. He's more troubled by the fact that the PACBI works closely with the Palestinian BDS National Committee, Burchett wrote, according to a copy of the letter obtained by the Free Beacon. The BNC is basically an umbrella organization for a foreign terrorist organization such as Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Burchett said he's worried donations donated to PACBI via Act Blue are, through BNC, directed to foreign terror organizations. Act Blue's partnership with PACBI is a sign of the growing influence the BDS movement is gaining in the Democratic Party and the liberal community that supports it. Act Blue is viewed as a central funding platform for Democratic politicians and far-left groups such as the Black Lives Matter movement. The platform was recently fined $3,300 by the Federal Election Commission for funneling illegal political contributions to the 2020 election cycle. Burchett maintains that Biden administration must investigate Act Blue to determine if it is violating U.S. anti-terrorism laws by funneling donations to PACBI. Anti-Semitism and terrorism have no place in the United States, so I'm hopeful your departments will investigate how funds are directed to these groups, by these groups, the lawmaker wrote. If donations are indeed winding up in the hands of terrorist organizations, you should do everything in your power to put an end to this and bring those responsible to justice. PACBI is one of those several foreign organizations that comprise the Global BDS Movement's Advocacy Network. Among the other members of the coalition are the designated terror groups Hamas, Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, Palestine and Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, General Command, and Palestinian Liberation Front, according to the Zakor Legal Institute's February 11 letter to Act Blue. Multiple online companies such as Zoom, YouTube, and Facebook have banned BDS supporters from their platforms for promoting hate speech and anti-Semitism. Act Blue's own terms of service include similar prohibitions against hate speech. As a terror-backed hate group, PACBI's activities constitute a violation of Act Blue's terms of service. Blue does not allow illegal, obscene, threatening, defamatory, or otherwise injurious content, according to Zakor Legal Institute. PACBI's role in the governing body of the BDS movement implicates it as a violating various anti-discrimination laws, including state anti-BDS laws. Act Blue did not return a request for comment from the Free Beacon. Big surprise there. Wow. Next up, I want to talk about the liberal democratic commie anti, I'm going to put it point blank out there, liberal democrat commie anti-American politics that are working on banning political and religious opinions in California. This article comes from Todd Starnes. It's at toddstarnes.com, but it's by Galeb Park, came out yesterday. The title was Police Officers with Religious or Conservative Values Could Be Banned Under California Law. A new California bill proposes removing police officers from serving. They have used loosely defined hate speech or in some ways are affiliated with a hate group. California State Assembly member Ash Kalfra from San Jose introduced a bill known as the California Law Enforcement Accountability Reform Act to combat the, quote, infiltration of extremists in our law enforcement agencies. The bill, AB 655, would mandate a background check for all officers who exchanged racist and homophobic messages. After the April 6th vote, Pacific Justice Institute senior staff attorney Matthew McReynolds slammed it as it purposely broad to allow Christians and conservatives to be labeled as hateful for opposing abortion or same-sex marriage. The CLEAR Act defines hate speech as advocating or supporting the denial of constitutional rights of, the genocide of, or the violence towards any group of persons based upon race, ethnicity, nationality, religion, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, or disability. The conservative attorney, in a letter to the Committee on Public Safety of the California State Assembly, also wondered how it would impact Muslims. Under the guise of addressing police gangs, the bill at the same time launches an inexplicable, unwarranted, and unprecedented attack on peaceable, conscientious officers who happen to hold conservative political and religious values. Indeed, this is one of the most undisguised and appalling attempts we have seen in more than 20 years of monitoring such legislation on the freedom of association and freedom to choose minority viewpoints, he added. National syndicated radio host Todd Starnes pointed out groups like the Family Research Council, American Family Association, and the Alliance Defending Freedom could also be considered hate groups as defined by the leftist Southern Poverty Law Center's defunct list. You've got to pay attention to this kind of nonsense, Todd Starnes said on Wednesday. Boy, is that the truth. You have to pay attention. And let me keep going, because this type of stuff is just kind of shocking. Well, I want you to think about this. While California is trying to take away people's freedom of speech, New York City is taking – oh, let me go one more thing here. I'm going to throw this in a little early. California is also this is a mind-blowing thing for me. The courts have won. The churches have won a court case. And they're currently – California is currently in full swing to remove Governor Gavin Newsom through a recall. But his tyrannical actions have left many churches still closed. Trevor, who is pastor of North Valley Baptist Church in California, had this to say. Now, this is just from March 14th. I have to say I'm surprised that some churches are still closed. I did not expect that. I have to say I was surprised to learn that. Now, this is an interesting statement. Here we go.
Governor Newsom, I implore you to open up our churches by Easter Sunday, April the 4th. This is Sunday, and it's early in the morning. We're freezing out here. We're cold. We've been obeying for 366 days, 1 year and 1 day. We've shut our church down. We're meeting in the parking lot. We're meeting in open-air meetings, and we have tents everywhere. People in their cars. People are down the street listening on the radio. We need our church open. My name is Jack Treber. I'm pastor of North Valley Baptist Church in Santa Clara, California, the Silicon Valley. My wife and I have been here 45 years, and we've tried to be good residents, great people in our city, and we've tried to train our people that way. But we're out here literally freezing in the winter through hail this past week as people sat here, and through rain, and we are very hot in the summer. Yet we have a 3,000-seat auditorium that sits empty. Now, we gave you last Easter. I preached an empty auditorium by myself in there to 3,000 people, our media people, that's it. In addition to Easter, we gave you Mother's Day and Father's Day. We gave you July 4th. We gave you Labor Day. We gave you all the summer. We gave you all the spring. We gave you all the fall. We gave you Thanksgiving. Even to your recommendation, don't congregate with families, and Christmas as well. New Year's, Valentine's Day, and it's enough is enough, sir. I'm not some wild maniac, but let me just tell you this in closing. We have had zero deaths in our church of thousands of people. We've had zero hospitalizations, and the few that have gone in to be hospitalized were sent home and said, take two Tylenol. We've had less than 20 cases in our church. We're healthy. We're open. And yet we're obeying all the laws. Here's what I'm asking you to do. Open up the church Easter Sunday. I'm asking you, secondly, let us take the mask off. Let us have the capacity crowd. Let us worship God. Let us have choir. It's hard to believe as a pastor, I'm asking government, can we open up? This is not a communist country. America has never shut the church down one Sunday. Spanish flu, never shut it down. All these different various viruses and illnesses and sickness, we've never closed the church. We have been closed 52 Sundays. Sir, with all due respect, enough's enough. I'm dealing with, in our area here, suicide, drug addiction. There is domestic violence. Children are losing their education, and we need to get back. Easter Sunday, April 4th, 2021. That gives us four Sundays. Let's open this thing up, sir. I plead you to get in touch with me. I have no way to get in touch with you. That's why I'm making this video. But my mayor has our phone, my personal cell number. Our congressman that you know very well who's called you on this has my cell number. You can get it from them. Call me direct. I'll drive to see you. I'll meet with you. We want to be safe, but we've been doing this for a year, sir. It's time. April the 4th, 2021, Easter Sunday for Christians, please.
It's hard to believe, when I think about it, that a church has not been meeting in all this time. I know that the shutdown here in New York State had many churches closed. I know that my church did not tell people they could not come. And, you know, I showed up at some point because I was just tired of worshiping alone. Because the purpose of church is for you gathering together and being with your brethren. And I went. And I have to say I enjoyed being there. There was only maybe a few people that weren't leadership. And it was just nice. I mean, again, I think stuff like denying yourself the ability to worship, I think that goes against the scriptures. That's my personal belief. I could not have kept the church closed that long. That's, again, my personal belief. So I do want to talk about something else that's been going on. This week, this is where it gets interesting. Liberal Democrat commies. Okay, let's get California. Well, California is trying to take away people's freedom of speech. New York City is taking away the children of those who don't wear their masks in cars. I saw this article 2 days ago in Gateway Pundit, and I have to say it shocks me. This is by Cassandra Fairbanks, again for Gateway Pundit, and says, exclusive, New York City judge removes a six-year-old from the mother because she didn't wear a mask while dropping her off at school. A New York City judge has removed a six-year-old girl from her mother because she didn't wear a mask while dropping her off outside of school. It was a normal day. Dr. Micheline, a family physician, when she went to drop her daughter off at Birch, Woffen, Lenox School on the Upper East Side last week until her entire life was turned upside down in an instant. The tearful mother explained in a phone call that her daughter was already inside the building and wearing a mask when the school nurse and school security attempted to force Dr. Epstein to wear a mask on the public street in front of the building where drop-off takes place. Dr. Epstein refused. No one got physical or anything. She just refused to wear the mask. They were outside on the public sidewalk. Dr. Epstein's boyfriend, Jeff Guttenplan, explained, adding that the daughter was wearing a mask because they are required to go inside. The mother explained that the school nurse had come out and was aggressively demanding that she put on a mask, but she was already leaving and didn't accept it. Next thing I know, my daughter is taken away from me, she cried. Dr. Epstein is separated from her daughter's father, and they had shared custody agreement where the child splits time between the home equally. The divorce, however, has been bitter. Following the confrontation at the school, Dr. Epstein left, but would soon find a letter from the expensive college prep school sent to her estranged husband and the attorneys for both parties. The school was demanding that Dr. Epstein no longer be permitted to drop off or pick up her child from school. If that already wasn't bad enough, the father used the notice about the mask situation to request an emergency hearing for full custody with Justice Matthew Cooper, granted after berating the already emotionally devastated mother. Quote, she's the love of my life, Dr. Epstein told the Gateway Pundit while trying and failing to hold back her tears. It's horrible. Please help us. Additionally, the court decided that the mother's not permitted to remove her daughter from the expensive school and told her that she doesn't have a choice in the matter. She is currently working three jobs to pay for not only her daughter's expenses, but the six lawyers she hired to fight what she is referring to as the kidnapping of her child. On Tuesday, Dr. Epstein was not permitted to see or even speak to her daughter, even though it was her sixth birthday. To get two supervised visits with her daughter per week, she'll need to wear a mask inside her own house. New York City is insane. It's not even like the rest of New York State. And this is why many people in New York State want New York City to be a separate country. Well, a separate state. They would love it. There's a lot of discussions. I'm out in Western New York State, and we consider them aliens in many ways. Hearing that, I guess you can see why we consider them aliens. Some of this stuff, it's so hard to believe. I mean, it's just, I don't know about you, but for me, it's mind-numbing. It's almost too hard to believe. Let's go back to this next one. This week, a coordinated effort of pro-life groups attempted to sway the Supreme Court to stop federal government from financing abortions. Now, this is an outstanding thing. I want you to think about this. This came from the Christian Post. It's written by Michael Grabowski from the Christian Post reporter. He writes the title is "Pro-Life Groups Ask Supreme Court to Stop Federal Government from Financing Abortions." A group of pro-life organizations have filed a brief asking the United States Supreme Court to stop the government from expanding the federal funding of abortions. The American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, and the Catholic Medical Association filed a supplemental brief in support of intervention on Monday in the consolidated cases of American Medical Association versus Cochran, Oregon versus Cochran, and Cochran versus Mayor and City Council of Baltimore. At issue in the cases is a 2019 rule enacted during the Trump administration that prohibits federal Title X family planning funding to go to entities that provide or promote abortions. Again, there was a prohibition to provide any funding at all for Title X to organizations that promote abortion. Now, in the supplemental brief, the pro-life groups expressed opposition to propose dismissal of the challenge by the Biden administration, which will likely reverse the 2019 rule. When the federal government issued valid administrative rules, the public interest supports enforcing those rules until they are changed through proper regulatory procedures. Abandonment of valid statutes and regulations signal the demise of rule of law itself, stated the brief in part. The only apparent purpose of proceeding via joint stipulation is to deprive interested parties of their ability to defend the 2019 rules. The pro-life groups are being represented by the Alliance Defending Freedom, a conservative law firm that specializes in religious liberty cases and has argued before the Supreme Court. Also expressed support for a joint motion of 19 states to ask the Supreme Court to stop the Biden administration from scrapping the 2019 rule on the Title X family planning funding. To be sure, some states provide such funding, and many advocates would like to see more public funding, but the broader national consensus against funding elective abortions remains, stated the joint motion. Title X funding. This consensus reflects this consensus. Since its 1970 enactment, the law has funded non-abortion family planning, all the while it has banned the use of Title X funds in programs where abortion is a method of family planning. In January, President Joe Biden issued a memorandum asking the Department of Health and Human Services to review restrictions on funding for entities that provide or promote abortion. Biden claimed that the Title X rule put undue restrictions on federal funding and put women's health at risk by making it harder for women to receive complete medical information. This law specifies that Title X funds may not be used in programs where abortion is a method of family planning, but places no further abortion-related restrictions on recipients of Title X funds. Based on that reasoning, actor solicitor General Elizabeth Preliger submitted a short brief to the Supreme Court last week asking them to dismiss the litigation over the 2019 rule. Now, I have worked for an organization in New York State, volunteering my time with Crisis Pregnancy Center here, working on well, this is a ways back, that was under Reagan, helping them to get some Title X funding. I don't understand how you can take that funds, and I don't understand how Biden could claim that they would not have information if they weren't, if money wasn't going to abortion clinics. The truth is, abortion clinics do not provide the full, they don't teach you everything about a person being alive within you. They teach you that is a separate, that is, you know, it's a part of you. It's not a separate human life. And that's an interesting thing. They'd rather teach you it's like a cancer. You have to remove it. To consider a child like a cancer, you have to remove. That is really a sick and really, I don't know what else to call it besides demonic to teach that. But that is what is taught in many of these abortion clinics when they're talking to future parents that they want to abort the child from. Some of this stuff is just so shocking. Well, the border crisis, we're going to get back into the border crisis manufactured by liberal Democrat President Joe Biden is allowing entry to felons and persons previously deported and barred from entry. How can this be good for America? I want you to think about that. Now, let me say that last week we had Todd Benjamin on, and we're going to talk about that again. But I want you to think of this one. This story comes from mrctv.org. Now, Brittany Hughes is the writer. She writes, 40-year-old convicted pedophile caught reentering the United States amid massive border surge. Border agents in El Paso apprehended a known criminal alien reentering the United States after having already been deported at least once following his criminal conviction for sexually abusing a child and drug trafficking. Border protection, the 40-year-old Mexican man was caught about 22 miles north of the border after having crossed illegally. A background check showed he'd been convicted in 2010 Stockton, California, for lewd acts upon a child 14 years old or younger, for which he was sentenced to a year in prison. He was also given another 3 years for transportation of a controlled substance following his release from prison. He returned to his home country, although border protection didn't make it clear whether he is immediately deported. The danger of dangerous criminal aliens re-entering the country through our poor southwest border compounds the current border crisis, in which thousands of illegal aliens, including families, unaccompanied children, and thousands more single adults, are streaming across from Mexico daily, some in groups traveling openly and others with help of human smugglers using stash houses to hide migrants. With sources stretched thin and border facilities overwhelmed with families and children, there's concern that even more criminal aliens could be slipping through unnoticed. Quote, I'm going to, on 24 years as a Border Patrol agent, I can tell you that I've never seen day-to-day, week-or-week increase like what I'm seeing right now. We've dealt with these kind of numbers in the past. We've dealt with them in the early 2000s. We dealt with them in 2014. We dealt with them in 2019. But what we didn't see during that time is we didn't see the rapid increase like we're seeing right now. That's from National Border Patrol Council President Brandon Judd. That's what he told Fox News. San Angelo Live reported that from March 6th to the 9th alone, border agents arrested 15 aliens wanted from crimes ranging from sexual assault of a child, burglary, possession of a controlled substance, aggravated assault of a family house member, and larceny. I want you to think about this. Is it okay for felons to come back? Now, keep in mind that we are talking about felons, and if you paid attention to what one of Biden's things was, he said that if you had been deported or refused under Trump, you have a right now to apply to be accepted into the United States. So is that not an encouraging statement for people to come who had been previously deported? Isn't that what that tells you? If you are, this is the stuff that bothers me. How can people not understand this, that this is not good for America? Again, last week we talked about terrorists coming over the border with the illegals with Todd Benzman. This week he broke a story with the Investigative Project on Terrorism on the media silence about publishing alleged covert Iranian agent work. Terrorism, and this is an article by Todd Benzman. He writes, more than 6 weeks have elapsed since the major American journalism scandal broke with the federal arrest of U.S. newspaper editorialists and frequent cable news commentator Kava Afrasabi, who long sold himself as a neutral expert on Iran. The initial Department of Justice media release alleged that during all the 13 years, Afrasabi wrote op-eds for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Times, and esteemed academic journals. The Islamic Republic of Iran was richly paying and directing him to propagandize for the regime and to lobby lawmakers, Capitol Hill staffers, State Department officials, and the White House. He is charged with failing to register as a foreign government agent, which of course would have blown what turned out to be a wildly successful operation. Afrasabi, who is representing himself in the case, has denied all wrongdoing, saying he is a final target of Trump's failed maximum pressure strategy on Iran. Iran went to bat for Afrasabi, calling his February arrest a hostage taking. American news media, which played the starring role, have left it at that. But this episode warrants far more excavation on the lessons learned. The federal government's case brims with largely unreported, troubling investigative details of a major Iranian intelligence success that was launched right at the decks of America's premier journalism academic institutions. Let me just read a list of websites that say they published his work. The New York Times, Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Boston Globe, Council on Foreign Relations, UN Chronicle, opinion articles in Harvard Belfer Center, The Guardian articles, Washington Post, Washington Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Al Monitor, Asia Times, French-German articles, Lebenschance, Schwabe, I believe that's German. There's more. If even a portion of the alleged duplicities prove out, the Afrasabi affair would qualify as a significant U.S. intelligence failure and landmark breakdown in the critical thinking tradition foundational to American journalism and academia. Afrasabi's writings, think about this. A yawning silence has followed Afrasabi's February arrest. Unlike many other publication scandals, the newspapers whose pages built Afrasabi's initial stature as a, quote, neutral Iran expert have applied no journalism to their fallen contributor or public introspection as to how Iranian intelligence so badly played them. An investigative project on terrorism search of the LexisNexis news database showed nothing there. Most of the articles remain published, including this September 5th, 2018, New York Times article titled, Trump and Rouhani Need to Talk. So they keep his stuff up, even knowing now that he was an Iranian agent. Wow. How about this one? He wrote another piece in the Harvard Theological Review, another one in the San Francisco Chronicle. Let me read this one from the New York Times. It says, Hussein Mousavian is a research scholar at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson Scholar School and a former spokesman for Iran's nuclear negotiations. Kaveh Afrasabi is a former political science professor at Tehran University. I'm a former advisor to the Iranian nuclear negotiating team. Not one has been updated to inform readers that prosecutors believe that the material is from an Iranian government agent. If you stumble into all those articles today, you would have no way of knowing a source's alleged connection to a hostile foreign government. No editorial page editors have been reported fired over this incident, in a sharp contrast to the resignation of the New York Times editorial page editor who allowed U.S. Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican of Arkansas, last summer to publish a call for possible military action to stop riots and looting in American cities. The FBI and federal prosecutors believe they have evidence to prove that Afrasabi is a paid and directly controlled by the Iranian government to lobby U.S. government officials, conduct public relations, and create and disseminate information publicly favorable to the Iranian government in the United States and abroad. He directly lobbied a member of Congress for policies favorable to Iran and published articles at the direction and under the control of the Iranian government. According to the U.S. government's narrative, Iran could directly order Afrasabi to write what it wanted in prominent publications at diplomatically opportune moments. It edited and pre-approved many of them and then had Afrasabi exploit those calling cards to access and lobby a spectrum of American government officials who had no idea who or what he really was. An FBI affidavit filed along with the initial complaint points to this 2012 New York Times op-ed, which argued that U.S. sanctions on Iran acted as a major stumbling block in nuclear negotiations, since Iranian negotiators needed to produce a tangible trade-off between any concessions and a recognition of Iran's right to legitimate nuclear enrichment. In email correspondence obtained by the FBI, Afrasabi refers to the United States as the enemy, and wrote that the U.S. government is in the palms of Zionists. Like the other articles cited above, this op-ed has not been updated to reflect Afrasabi's indictment for acting as an agent of the Iranian government. None of the publication gatekeepers would have accepted his writings had they known the secret that Afrasabi allegedly was keeping for so long. One would hope something's going to happen. The 65-year-old Afrasabi came to America in 1973. He became a legal permanent resident in 1984 and then became a naturalized U.S. citizen, Iran's permanent mission at the United Nations in New York surreptitiously put Afrasabi on its payroll in 2007. That was a tense time when George W. Bush's administration, Iran, and Israel were rattling war sabers over Iran's nuclear weapons program. Registering as a foreign agent, of course, would have immediately short-circuited any chance of success with his influence operation. In a filing last week, Afrasabi acknowledged receiving $3,000 per month from the Iranian UN mission, along with health insurance. Let that hit you. Todd continues, of course, canons of professional opinion journalism forbid any writings. Their subjects share undisclosed political and financial links because such conflicts of interest undermine credibility. So ethical editors, schooled in professional standards, would have especially frowned had they known about the extreme degree to which Iran violated this canon. For years, Afrasabi's Iranian government handlers, the head diplomat, the press officer at the New York mission, at least ordered him to pen diplomatically beneficial articles at key moments. Their involvement went deep. They edited his content, pre-approved his writings, and gave him talking points for television, the government alleges. Take the time in 2011 when Saudi Arabia, the Sunni archenemy of the Shiite Iran, sent troops to help Bahrain arrest Shiite demonstrators during the Arab Spring uprising there. The Iranian press secretary, according to the DOJ complaint, directed Afrasabi to publish an article advocating what the Iranian regime wanted to have happen. The article should call for the European Union to penalize Bahrain if it did not stop arresting Shiites, and also to call for a Saudi troop withdrawal. Quote, on Bahrain, you know the situation is very tragic, unquote. The Iranian press secretary emailed Afrasabi, quote, can we talk to publish some article on that, unquote. A couple of weeks later, an article co-authored by Afrasabi appeared in the Guardian newspaper advocating diplomatic and economic reprisals against Bahrain, travel bans on its officials, and a demand that Saudi Arabia withdraw forces, the DOJ complaint noted. Wow. There is a lot more to this article. I think people need to pay attention. This article exposes the lack of work, the lack of ethics in many media institutions, many news agencies, that they won't stand up, that they won't say what's ethically correct. I fight to get out what is true. It's, you know, for me, it's sometimes a losing battle because there's just so much news out there. It's hard to get all of it, and it's hard for me to decide what to share sometimes. And I don't have to say that's probably a problem with most news agencies. You end up making choices you probably don't want to have to make. But, you know, I don't understand them not exposing that they had been duped. I mean, admitting to a problem is how you move ahead. You have to admit there's a problem before you can solve a problem. That's extremely important, and they are not going to do that, which I consider extremely sad. Well, here's another article. It's really another little known story. Came out this week in another PJ Media article. President Biden's administration ordered the U.S. Navy to, quote, stand down its global operations and subject all its members to what is characterized as training to recognize and combat extremism. This was written by Ted Mahan. It came out yesterday. Now, if you're a Navy man, if you're a military man, this article should highly offend you. It should bother you. Now, there's an editor's note that I want to read here. It says, in the wake of January 6th Capitol riot, the Biden administration ordered the U.S. Navy to, quote, stand down its global operations and subject all members to what it characterizes as training to recognize and combat extremism. This piece below was written by an active duty military member who has about 20 years of service. The member has been deployed overseas in the war on terror multiple times. The piece describes the Navy's extremism stand down, what it includes and what it leaves out. Ted Mahan is not the member's real name. So again, it was the name that was credited as the author, but again, it's not his real name. That's why I wanted to read this. Okay, recently, my Navy unit held an extremism stand down, he writes. Training that was required of all Department of Defense personnel is mandated by Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. According to Vice Admiral John B. Noel, Jr., the purpose of the training was to ensure service members and civilian personnel clearly understand the damaging effect of extremism and begin developing more forceful, sustainable ways to eliminate the corrosive impacts extremist activity can have on our force. That aim, of course, is laudable. Our Navy is diverse and we are strong, not because of diversity, but because of the unity we have as Americans, regardless of race. This Navy man writes, when I go to sea or deploy on land, he knows that the mission depends on those around him. Good men and women of all races committed to defending our nation. Ultimately, they have his back, too, and his life depending on them. Any attack on one is attack on all. Right up to this point, this man is 100% with the Navy's brass's goal. But it's not actually what the training says. The training they received this month was rushed through in the wake of the Washington, D.C. riot. The course, which was given in PowerPoint deck, included a slide defining extremism. One would expect a broad catch-all phrase that makes it clear that any radical activity undermining our nation or promoting criminal activity would not be tolerated. But that would be wrong. Extremism was narrowly defined as supremacist beliefs only, that it's nothing else, nothing about anarchism, nothing about a group that might be found on the left. Everyone in the room, every race, incidentally, had a collective hush as the chilling effect of this clearly biased definition dawned on our team. As one person on that team put it, why does the DOD care about one kind of extremism? Why do they refuse to talk about Antifa? Why is it extremist to attack a Capitol police officer, but not extremist to attack a Portland police officer? Why, he continues, we were further lectured that supremacists were seeking to join the military to gain skills and proficiency with weapons. But of course, this man knows that inner city gangs have been trying this for years, yet there was no discussion of that, nor was there any mention of Antifa, which explicitly and openly promotes violent activities. Seems odd that in 2020, when we saw 1,000 riots with varying levels of violence, our training would be centered on the one riot connected to the right and ignore the 999 connected to the left. Throughout the presentation, the drumbeat was consistent, constant, and chilling. This was a shot across the bow to the right, a deafening silence for the left, as true Americans committed to our fellow servicemen and women. He writes, we should reject all extremism unequivocally from any source. He writes, my concern is that this blatantly political training is not only bad, it's counterproductive. Extremists feed on paranoia, and the Department of Defense just fed them a healthy dose of it. What do they think these people will do? Admiral made them sit through 3 hours of lectures. Hardly. They'll go underground. They'll continue to fester, and so too will the left. And only no one will be watching out for them, because the brass's silence speaks volumes. Well said, Mr. Navy man of 20 years. Well said. Some of these things that I share, they're shocking. And I want to keep going here. There's just so much. And we're at 7:13 already. And I'm just amazed. I don't know if I will ever be able to get through all of this. Let me keep going. Meanwhile, things are full blown idiocy in New York State, California, and anywhere else liberals rule America. Because of that, Florida's looking so good that the liberal media hacks have had to report it. That's not something they like to do. Wow. So they're reporting on the good things that are happening in Florida. Don't you remember them giving Ron DeSantis a hard time? They referred to him as many things, but yeah, they've never said anything nice that I can remember. But now the media is waking up. Is that good? Steven Cruiser for PJ Media writes, the morning briefing, Ron DeSantis is the perfect antidote to Republican squishies. Thursday, dear Cruz, morning briefing friends, he writes, I hope everyone had a wonderful St. Patrick's Day, he writes. I forgot to wish you all a happy one yesterday because I was still a little loopy from Pfizer round one. For the record, none of us with Irish ancestry, Steven Cruiser. For the record, he says, none of us with Irish ancestry care so much scarce that so many appropriate our culture every March 17th, usually because we're too drunk to care. He writes, my corned beef and cabbage were perhaps the best ever this year. He thought that even before the Guinness and Jameson started to kick in, it was just harmonic convergence of taste bud perfection. He had no idea how. He's single. It has been about a month since his last lead briefing from righteous Ron DeSantis praise. At the rate the Florida governor is going, he may have to make it a recurring weekly segment. The youngest governor in America is on a seemingly unstoppable roll these days. This is a most opportune time to reflect on what DeSantis has accomplished this past year, since it's the first anniversary of the world's plunge into the COVID madness. For much of the year, the American mainstream media regaled us with stories about their holy trinity of American governors, Andrew Cuomo, Gretchen Whitmer, and Gavin Newsom, per the MSM. Virtually every move made was redefining real leadership. What they did write about DeSantis, it was to say that he had blood on his hands for keeping his state open. Well, a year later, both Cuomo and Newsom are facing bipartisan calls for them to either be recalled or resign. A special prosecutor is going to start looking into Whitmer's mishandling of the COVID crisis. It's not just that the three of them weren't doing their job while they were being freed, feted by the media. It's that each was doing them as poorly as they possibly could. Cuomo was groping every woman within arm's reach on top of that. Meanwhile, Governor Blood on His Hands was actually doing things so well that CNN just wrote a glowing profile by their standards of him. You know that had to hurt. Now, DeSantis has let it be known that Florida won't be playing nice with the anti-American critical race theory pimps they're trying to indoctrinate our children. He writes, Stacey, and this again, this was an article written by Stacey. He goes in and says, look, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has taken to the state level while parents in many states are fighting at the local level with their school boards. With the pandemic forcing many children to take classes remotely, the nationwide protests and riots during the summer of 2020 and the launch of 1619 Project, parents have become aware of the radical ideas schools are imparting to their children. One of the threats involves content based on critical race theory, which claims that America is fundamentally racist and people are either oppressed or oppressors based solely on their racial identity. During a press conference in Naples, Florida, DeSantis made clear what schools in Florida would be teaching. It is not a curriculum based on critical race theory. This is what DeSantis said. Quote, Florida civics curriculum will incorporate foundational concepts with the best materials, and it will expressly exclude unsanctioned narratives like critical race theory and other unsubstantiated theories, DeSantis said at a press conference Wednesday in Naples, calling that and other theories politicized academic fads. He said, let me be clear. Again, this is Ron DeSantis, Governor DeSantis. Let me be clear, he said. There's no room in our classrooms for things like critical race theory. Teaching kids to hate their country and to hate each other is not worth one red cent of taxpayer money. Yeah. Governor DeSantis, I love you. I wish we could get you here in here in New York State. Wow. Governor DeSantis announced an incentive for teachers in Florida to take a training in this statewide civics program. He said teachers will receive $3,000 bonus if they get certified. The curriculum supports graduating seniors taking a civics test similar to those taken in the citizenship process. Some of us are old enough to remember when this was required to graduate even in left-wing California. Governor DeSantis is bringing it back to Florida. That's fantastic news. Now, this is the man that they did not like. And you know what? His work is when you hear some of the things that are happening in this state, you sit there, or in this country, you sit there wondering, how can we miss these things? I mean, why isn't this stuff being out there? Why aren't they sharing it? Well, the good news is coming out of Florida. Virginia's Democratic gubernatorial candidates are finding out that they have one thing in common, and it's not something good. It's that they hate Israel. Adam Credo has the story with the Free Beacon, Washington Free Beacon. The title is Virginia Democratic Gubernatorial Contenders Endorse BDS Movement. An entire panel of Democratic candidates for Virginia governor endorsed the anti-Semitic boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement during a Tuesday evening debate. Each of the candidates participating in the virtual Virginia's People's Debate promised to buck pressure from pro-Israel groups that want to see the state outlaw the BDS movement due to its association with virulent anti-Israel figures and terrorist group operating abroad. Wait a minute. They're going to support the groups that, did you catch this? That have association with virulent anti-Israel, which are an ally. I mean, again, they're supporting groups that go against an ally of the United States, and they're supporting terrorist groups. These people are running for governor. Do they not remember what happened here? Well, it's not a surprise. If you're a Democrat these days, you are basically communist. Scary. Adam Credo continues, former Virginia governor Terry McAuliffe, a Clinton ally, widely seen as a forerunner in the race, did not participate in the forum, but has come out in the past against the BDS movement. He was one of 50 governors to endorse an anti-BDS campaign organized by the American Jewish Committee. He didn't respond to Washington Free Beacon requests for comment on the debate and his current view of the BDS movement. Those candidates hoping to beat on McAuliffe took a decidedly different approach Tuesday evening when they were asked a loaded question by the debate monitor about how they would approach the BDS movement, which was described as a form of peaceful protest to secure Palestinian rights. Well, let's think about this. Is there a country named Palestine? No. Is there a place where – I mean, this the insanity of this. You're calling people – again, this is people who are in a Muslim-controlled area of the country of Israel. Palestine was a name given by the Romans to insult the Jews. It means land of the Philistines. Now, if you meet someone who in Arabic, who does not speak English or Latin, and they can pronounce Palestine, please let us know, because I've yet to hear that one. Yeah, I'm... You know, when you hear some of these things, you sit there and go, why is it happening? You sit there, I'm surprised when I hear some of these things. These people are running for office, and they're going to endorse the enemies of our allies. They're going to endorse the terrorists. And they're serious contenders for a gubernatorial office. This is the best the Democrats can offer in Virginia. Oh, my gosh. Well, is it any surprise they gave us Joe Dementia? Yes, and for some reason, which supposedly can't be election fraud, Joe Dementia became the man who really didn't run at all. He hid in his basement, somehow became president of the United States without election fraud. If you believe that, I got a bridge I can sell you in Brooklyn. Now, I do want to keep going. Schools are currently being closed when kids are proven to be less susceptible to COVID-19 is not right. Christopher Bedford wrote about COVID. He wrote an article entitled COVID Isn't a Threat to American Kids. Selfish teachers, their unions, and their Democrat allies are. I think this is an article you need to hear. So without further ado, again, this is from Christopher Bedford. You can find it in the Federalist. He writes, it's time we realize we are not in this together. Yes, we've heard that from Hollywood videos and Super Bowl ads and from politicians and commercials, But unfortunately, it just ain't so. When President Joe Biden made a rare public appearance from CNN Town Hall in February, for example, Justin Bellot, a teacher in his mid-30s, asked, why is it okay to make him and his colleagues go back to their classrooms and do their jobs? Why should teachers have to work? The young man asked, when subjected to large class sizes and outdated ventilation systems, should all staff, he wondered, be vaccinated before they were subjected to this treatment? Please remember, I am a retired special education teacher. So I'm sitting here laughing. This guy is 100% right. The teacher, but Christopher Bedford. Don't worry, the president soothed. This is the president of the classes will be small. The government will make sure you are protected from COVID-19. Teachers and the folks who work in the schools, the cafeteria workers, the others, he explained, should be on a list of preferred to get a vaccination. Smart answer. Threads the needle and all. If you're, say, a bartender, however, and a whore, hotel maid, or a desk clerk, or a bus or subway driver, a gas station attendant, or a grocery store employee, a waiter, a manager, a delivery man, a farmer, a rancher, a factory worker, carpenter, butcher, trucker, pilot, priest, police officer, EMT, cab driver, blah, 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 blah. You might be wondering why you're at work. Why aren't the teachers? Yes. You probably haven't gotten a vaccine. And if you have it, very likely it wasn't by virtue of having returned to work months ago or maybe never even being able to break from your job at work. Nobody promised you a new ventilation system. The president didn't coo sweet nothings into your ear when you were scared. And you might even be 65 or older, meaning there's an actual reason for you to be cautious. The reason for the discrepancy, of course, is that despite what we've heard from Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Wells Fargo and the cast of High School Musical, we're not in this together. We are very much separated from each other, masked up, suspicious, angry, and atomized to the point that some of us still can't see our sick or aging family in the pecking order of who will be taken care of first. Most of us are far behind the politically favored and well-connected. A number of those who aren't in this with you, the Speaker of the House, the Mayor of Austin, the entire cast of Saturday Night Live, for example, have been thoroughly exposed. But for some reason, we all feel the need to continue to tiptoe around one of the most awful, lazy, and selfish group in America, the left-wing public teachers unions, and the teachers who support them. I know there are states across the country where public school teachers have gone back to work just like the rest of us. I know there are public schools who want to go back to work and teach kids, school teachers who want to go back to work and teach kids in person, and who are heartbroken over the damage their colleagues are inflicting on America's children. But there are tens of thousands of teachers singing a very different song, and theirs is by far the loudest. These are teachers like the ones in Los Angeles who warned colleagues not to post their spring break pictures, pointing out it's hard to argue that it's unsafe for in-person instruction if parents and public see vacation photos and international travel. Or the one in Los Angeles who sent an email to a mother who criticized the union asking what her race is. Just a week ago, California politicians agreed to pay 6.6 billion ransom just for the unions to agree to teach again. Okay, this goes on. Let me tell you, in New York State, the reason why many schools are not back is because under King Andy, when he was head of the kingdom here, because we did not have a legislature, we had a kingdom. When King Andy was in charge, he issued an edict that does not allow students to be closer than 9 feet. Now, because of this problem that the school districts have accepted, which, again, they're not allowing students to return to schools because they can't physically fit them in the schools. Until the state says, these are stupid regulations, and they have been until the state says, these are stupid, schools can't return the kids to school because then they fear they will lose their state financing in New York State, and I'm sure in some other states, that is a problem. They have closed schools, and some in New York State, some kids are going part-time. Some kids are getting more time. And then there's a day during the week where they clean the school. Oh, it's a thorough washdown. Kind of hard to believe. Did they hire a lot more people just to clean the schools? Again, school districts are hurting for money. To think that they hired a whole team of cleaners is kind of shocking to hear. I personally don't believe it. I don't think they have the staff to do it. But that's what they're telling you. They've hired a whole bunch of people to clean the schools. This is the stuff, the misinformation that's getting out there. It doesn't make any sense. I am all for kids going back to school. One of the reasons I retired last year is I was sick and tired of Zoom teaching. Personally, detest it, hate it, and you know what? I was 55. I was done. Besides being assaulted a couple times by kids when it's not a felony anymore to assault school staff. So in public schools in New York State, yeah, they've changed it to a misdemeanor. So you're not allowed to assault a public bus transport. That's a felony. But you're allowed to assault a school teacher. And that's one of the reasons I'm out. Yes. Going on, we did have good news this week. And I do want to share this really, really good news. This came from North Carolina. North Carolina's Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, he is a breath of fresh air. He started a new website where parents and others can report indoctrination in schools. Now, if you're listening to me, you should be hearing this, and this information is kind of shocking. ABC 11 had the story. The title, this is by Tim Pulliam. The article is titled, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson Launches New Website to Report Indoctrination in North Carolina Public Schools. Now, again, I love this article. I hope that you go to abc11.com and see it. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson says some kids and educators have concerns over what's being taught in North Carolina public schools. So on Tuesday, he launched the Facts Task Force on his official government page. Quote, if I go into the classroom and I can't put my opinion aside long enough to go inside the classroom and give impressionable young minds just the facts without my opinion, I have failed as an educator, quote, Robinson said during news conference. Facts stand for fairness, accountability in the classroom for teachers and students. Concerned people can submit online and include examples of discrimination or harassment, examples of students being influenced by political opinions and ideologies, and proof of inappropriate content or subject matter. During the news conference, Robinson, who is the state's first black lieutenant governor, claimed a female student was not allowed to write a report on him for Black History Month. Her teacher would not allow her to do that and told her that she had to do her report on Tupac Shakur. This is indoctrination, he said. The task force wants to collect the data, analyze it, and then determine which complaints are the most urgent. We will know how we're going to tackle this after we get the information and disseminate it, he said. We need to make sure there is equity in the classroom and make sure people are treated fairly. The Education Justice Alliance said that Robinson's task force is unnecessary. Oh, unnecessary? Have you been in a public school lately? It's necessary. I'm just going to leave it at that because this is incredibly important. I wish they would do this in every state because it might bring us back to where we need to be. Now, I have another article which is not kind, and it's a little shocking. And that was the good news for the week. Unfortunately, that is really the only good news I have this week. This week, sad to say, an article came out yesterday about a biotech researcher who submits to Islam, who was planning to create a bioweapon. The New York Post had the story. This is by Kenneth Garger. It came out yesterday. A research director at a Massachusetts biotechnology firm has been arrested by federal authorities for allegedly trying to acquire the highly toxic poison ricin. All right, are you hearing this? Does that sound like a memory? Yeah, ricin. Oh, it's a little scary. Dr. Ishtiaq Ali Saeem, 37, who has a doctorate in biomedical engineering, allegedly wanted to extract the toxin from 100 packets of castor bean that he ordered, according to U.S. Attorney's Office for Massachusetts. Each packet contained 8 beans. Saeem, who was from Pennsylvania, is accused of lying to investigators who questioned his purchase, telling that he only meant to buy 1 packet of castor beans to plant and decorate his home with, prosecutors said. After the first inquiry, prosecutors said Saeem researched homemade tasteless poisons. In his second meeting with authorities, he again claimed the castor beans were simply meant for planting at home. Saeem is charged with 1 count of obstruction of justice. Now, yeah, they are trying, I mean, I want you to think about this. They are looking at him as having wanted to extract toxin from 100 packets of castor beans. Yeah. Something to think about. That came out yesterday. We're going to go across the pond, and this time, instead of going straight to the UK, which is where we usually go first, today we're going to France. This week, a friend of mine, Leslie Shaw, sent me an article from La Parisienne. Now, this article, and I'll try and get it open, had 2 Islamic teenagers being arrested for associating with terrorists and expressing an interest in acts of terror on French soil. Now, it's interesting when you talk about things in Europe, a lot of times names of people are missing. Anything that would indicate that the persons who are committing the acts of terror is hidden. They hide their where they are from. They hide if they're migrants. They hide. And this is interesting because when I read this article, you may hear some things that are not often in there. The title of the article is "They Are in a Personal Drift," quote, radicalized teenagers suspected of plans for attacks indicted. It starts out, according to our information, the police officers of the General Director of Internal Security arrested a minor and a young adult in the Paris region and Marseille on Wednesday, each suspected of a violent action project, in particular against the military that they were indicted on Saturday. The Islamic terrorist threat is still very much alive in France, and these 2 projects of attacks, these are 2 plans, were put down in the space of a week. They illustrate acutely the risk emanating from very young men indoctrinated by Islam on the internet, prey to social fragility. According to the sources close to the investigation, listen to the ages. A 17-year-old and 18-year-old were taken into custody on Wednesday by police from the General Directorate of Internal Security as part of a 2 anti-terrorism investigation. Montelegeau in Marseille, these 2 radicalized suspects would have considered taking violent action on French soil. Both were indicted this Saturday evening by an anti-terrorism judge for criminal terrorist association and placed in pretrial detention. They both have profiles of young men active on social networks and are in a certain, quote, personal drift, says a source close to investigations. The first, still a minor, admitted to investigators that he planned and wanted to attack military targets, in particular soldiers on duty out of hatred of France. The investigations launched at the end of January 2021 as part of an investigation opened by National Anti-Terror Prosecutor's Office made it possible to highlight an active search on its targets as well as its accomplices. A resident in Avion was arrested at his mother's home, and the teenager was a member of Telegram channel bringing together radicalized individuals. Radicalized individuals. What would that be? Followers of Islam who are devout. Is there anything unusual about those beliefs? No. So the word radical does not fit. This is my claim against the claim that there's such a thing as radical Islam. Talk to a Muslim. You'll find out there is no such thing as radical Islam. So this is where it gets important to understand this claim that they keep using the term radical. They don't really understand. And that's or they do when they're lying to you. That's the problem. Again, this 17-year-old was going to make France pay for participating in the anti-ISIS coalition. The second suspect, the 18-year-old, entered the sites of anti-terrorism justice following a home visit. A device that followed the administrative searches of the state of emergency carried out of his Marseille home on Wednesday. The police officers have discovered an impressive number of terrorist propaganda documents. According to the first investigations, young man, Franco-Algerian, which means he has a parent who is from France and a parent from Algeria, had shown his willingness to join Syria. He was in virtual contact with jihadis in the theaters of war. Okay, we're talking about they live in Syria and they're part of ISIS. But lately he would have given up his project of hijra, emigrating to another country for jihad, to lead instead a violent action in France. In context of discussion with other young people in Europe, he would have mentioned several projects as well as sensitive targets in France. So they're saying that he was planning this. Now, I want you to think about that. So they caught these guys before they did. What do they have in common? One thing. It's not just their age that they're looking at. This is something to think about. Well, and on top of that, there was a terrorist action this week. Now, some people are saying, I will admit, some people are claiming this is not a terrorist action. This also comes from La Parisa. Paris, a man with a knife shot dead by a police officer. Basically, this week, a police officer was attacked around 11:45 in the morning. And, you know, police get there, and this man takes a knife and starts to attack the cop. The police officer shoots the man three times. He's put down. And the policeman's in shock that he's actually had to draw his weapon and defend himself against an attempted homicide. The officer is horrified and has been taken to a hospital. They're not recognizing this as a terror attack, which is sad because there are reasons to believe it's a terror attack. Let's put it this way. My LinkedIn connections in France believe this was a terrorist attack. Terrorist attack. They have, so, you know, I'm going with the comments I've seen from my friends in France who have those connections who could say that they believe this. I do want to share another article here from the Netherlands. Abigail Essman, who often writes for the Investigative Project on Terrorism, wrote an article this week for Allgemeiner. And I think this article is incredibly important. It came out March 11th. And now Abigail Essman is one of these outstanding writers that people really need to pay attention. So whenever she writes something, I'll tell you, I look for it, her work, because it's outstanding. So Abigail Essman wrote an article titled "Islamist Extremists Try to Silence Dutch Author with Death Threats." At 23, her first book tops her country's bestseller list, an autobiographical novel praised by critics nationwide. She has been featured in interviews on TV and newspaper articles and in women's magazines. but now members of her own community are threatening to kill her, and her mother thinks they're right. This isn't happening in Iran, Saudi Arabia, or Iraq. It's happening in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, that alleged bastion of tolerance and freedom. Lale Gül, the daughter of Turkish immigrants to the Netherlands, penned, "Ika ga levin, I shall live," to show a look into her culture through the eyes of a young woman who, like Gül herself, lives a kind of double life, a young, freewheeling, and independent Western girl in the outer world, while a dutiful, pious Muslim daughter at home. Through the character of Busra, Gül decries the oppressiveness of the community and culture in which she had been raised, a family in which she was forbidden to wear jewelry or makeup, to join school field trips without a male family member, to be friends with a boy, especially one who was not Turkish. Like Busra, Gül's own parents are deeply religious, especially her mother, who she says fully supports October's beheading by a Muslim terrorist, a French history teacher, Samuel Paty. Paty's moral sin, he had shown his students a caricature of the Prophet Muhammad. Its perspective, Gül finds deep. Volstrant, Gül began wrestling with Islam early, struggling to reconcile the lessons she learned in Quran school with what she studied in her elementary and high school classes. When she asked in Quran school why girls had to cover their heads and not boys, the teacher claimed the question had been whispered to her by the devil. This is the perspective she brought to her book. Naively, she admits now she thought her parents would never really know what she'd written. Her mother's illiterate. Neither parent speaks or reads much Dutch. What she didn't count on was the effect of the publicity and the rapid spread of tales throughout a small community like her own. A young, successful novelist, a Muslim woman at that, and beautiful, with a controversial tale to tell. She was a perfect subject for the media. But after one particular TV appearance, as one critic wrote, it was as if a bomb exploded in her parents' community. The main problem was her battle with Orthodox Islam, with the questioning of a culture in which, as Busra puts it, girls are forced to live like houseplants and become breeding hens. And once they are forced into a marriage, is this what I live for, Busra muses, God then happy with my tragedy. Phones rang in the Gül household the day after her appearance on a talk show in early February. Lal's parents listened, horrified, to friends and relatives explaining to them what their daughter actually had written, how she had exposed their private life to the outer world, and how she had spoken against their faith. Some of what her parents heard was untrue. An uncle threatened to punch my teeth out of my mouth, she told the Volstrant. And her mother, Lal said, defended him. I can't say he's wrong, she said, says her mother told her. You asked for it with that book. That wasn't the only time her mother expressed violent wishes against her own daughter. Quote, I understand that people want to strangle you, Lyle's mother told her, according to an interview in the Amsterdam Daily, Het Parool. If you weren't my child, I probably would have strangled you too. The young author has faced a barrage of threats from strangers, both online and on the street. She rarely leaves home now, fearing for her safety. She declined to be interviewed for this article, fearing further threats. She has been vilified in Turkey, thanks in part to a tweet from former Geert Wilders ally Arnaud Van Doon, now an Orthodox Muslim and leader of his own anti-Semitical political party, alleging that she had left Islam and was proud of it. Some of this furor had been nearly humorous. In response to Van Doorn, Gül asked him to remove his tweet, calling him a dirty dog. Van Doorn then filed a police report against her, saying the words dirty dog had offended him. But little else is funny. Gül believes it will no longer be possible for her to visit Turkey as a result of Van Doorn's actions. She relies on her brother to protect her. She has been advised to take on a bodyguard, though to date she has rejected the idea. Fans compare her to activist Ayan Hirsi Ali, the former Dutch parliamentarian and ex-Muslim, who has been an outspoken advocate for the rights of Muslim women and for ex-Muslims worldwide. She waves off the comparison, calling Hirsi Ali her hero. Now when Gül holds her to her principles, proud that she has provided a glimpse into the world she and many other young Muslim women are forced to live in, it is clear that the pressure has taken a toll. She has considered leaving home, but decided against it. I would no longer have a family, she told Hyperol. I am trying to make clear by saying that no, I won't leave you because I love you, and I hope one day you will also love me. Abigail Espen, you paint so many important things with your words. I hope others get a chance to know your work as I have been enjoying these past few years. I want to tell you about several other good news entities that are out there, including I'm talking about the network that we have, the Global Patriot Radio Network. We have an outstanding group of people here. Now, tomorrow we have Dr. Andrew Herod. Now, Dr. Andrew Herod is on at noon, and I tell you, you need to listen to his show. He brings in some outstanding research and some outstanding scholars. You definitely want to listen to his work. And if you come back on Saturday, we have Usama Dakdak, Understanding Islam. You would definitely want to come in and give a good listen. He's somebody that I've enjoyed listening to and working with, and outstanding work. On Sunday, we have Erica Kafiristan. If you get a chance, you need to listen to his debates and the discussions that he has with Crossing the Crescent. And why do I say that? Because there are, it's not just him on top of that. He has a team of people that contribute to this. And, you know, it's one thing when it's a one-man show, which mine pretty much is. His is no longer a one-man show. You'll hear, I've seen as many as six people on the show sharing and debating. And I continue to learn from that. Now, he's on Sundays and on Tuesday, so definitely want to catch the work of Erica Kafiristan. And then on Mondays, we have the Real Radio Men, Al and Vito, for the Vito Esposito Show. That's on at 6 o'clock on Monday. You definitely want to come back and listen. And on Wednesday, we have Hal of Poly Sports. Definitely want to come back and catch that one. And next Thursday, I will have another interview and something to share with you. But the news just never stops. I'm doing what I can to get the news out to you. I know I can't get it out every day like I have been in the past. That's from something new I'm learning due to changes in my schedule and life. So I'm asking that you would join, if you do Facebook, join the Sutliffing Report. That's a group on Facebook now. Join me on LinkedIn. Those are the two places I can recommend, and I will do what I can to keep you informed. Please, please do what you can to stay informed today. I think I have time for one more story. Let's see if I can do this one more story here. Yeah. let's see. All right, let's talk about what's happening in Nigeria. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with what Al-Qaeda called the War of the Hijab, the Battle for the Hijab. Osama bin Laden referred to the Battle of the Hijab as one of the all-important things that Al-Qaeda should be engaged in, that Islam is engaged in. Now, that is a battle to enforce the hijab on every woman in the world. Now, again, the reason for the hijab, according to the Quran, according to the Hadith, according to Sharia, is to prevent a Muslim man from sexually molesting you. That is the stated reason. When you think about that, again, if you think about that, it says that you are a Muslim woman. Keep this in mind. This comes from Nigeria. The article is titled Hijab Crisis. Christian schools never forced Muslim students to join Christianity, ACSN president. Now, this came out March 12th. It's in The Nation, line again from Nigeria. This article talks about what the – I want you to think about. They're talking about a lot of things, but pay real close attention. This is by Khaled Ademi, National President of Association Christian Schools in Nigeria. Dr. Akate Atang said Christian schools never coerced or forced any Muslim student to follow Christian religion. She vowed that the schools will never bow to pressure and intimidation of Kwara state government to admit wearing of hijabs as one of their policies, thereby changing its identity. Dr. Atang, who revealed this at press briefing, said anybody who is willing to attend Christian schools in the country must be ready to abide by the policy and rules. These mission schools are helping government carry out its function, and it's only reasonable they receive support from government support that should be used to muzzle them, control them, or seek to change their age, long laid down procedures, which have shaped many lives. We are a mission Christian school, unapologetically, and those who want to attend our schools should be ready to abide by our policies and rules. We do not in any way coerce or force students to follow our religion. It is a privilege to be admitted and attend Christian schools, and it's not a right. If Christian children chose Muslim schools, they'll be expected to abide by the school policies and rules there. Now, why is he saying this? Because the Muslims have issued a statement expecting the Christians to obey their rules. Islamization requires you to obey their rules. That is the difference between Christianity and Islam. I want to say thank you for listening. It has been a wonderful night with you. And I'm going to send you off with my favorite, The Red, White, and Blue by Toby Keith.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole of the red, white, and blue. Justice will be served and the battle will rage. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. You'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. Cause we'll put a boot in your ass. It's